settlements within a day's walk, but I'm sorry to report they all fall under the jurisdiction of our same godless chief, Tata Ndu. Father never lets me go that far, but I beg him anyhow. I try to avoid the drudgery of housekeeping chores, which is more up Rachel's alley if she can stoop to being helpful on a given day. My view of the home is it is always better to be outside, so I loiter at the edge of the village waiting for Father's return. There, where the dirt road makes a deep red cut between high yellow walls of grass, you never know what might be coming toward you on dusty feet. Women, usually carrying the world on their heads, a huge glass demijohn full of palm wine with a calabash bowl perched on top like an upside-down hat, or a bundle of firewood tied up with elephant grass topped off with a big enamel tub full of greens. The Congolese sense of balance is spectacular. Most of the girls my age or even younger have babies. They appear way too young to be married till you look in their eyes. Then you'll see it. Their eyes look happy and sad at the same time, but unexcited by anything, shifting easily off to the side as if they've already seen most of what is there. Married eyes. And the younger girls, if they are too young to be married and too old to be strapped on someone's back, which is not a wide margin, why, they come striding along, swinging their woven bags over their shoulders and scowl at you as if to say, "Out of my road, can't you see I'm busy?" They may only be little girls tagging after their mothers, but believe you me, with them it's all business. The girls are usually just about bald, like the boys. Mother says it's from not getting their proteins. But you can tell the girls by their stained, frilly dresses, cast-offs from some distant land. It took me aback for months that they looked so much like little boys in ruffly dresses. No girl or woman wears pants, ever. We are the odd birds here. Apparently they think we're boys, except maybe Rachel, and can't tell one of us apart from the other. They call us all Belezi, which means Belgians. I mean to tell you, they call us that right to our faces. It's how they greet us. Mbote, Belezi. The women smile, but then cover their mouths, embarrassed. The little babies take one look and burst out crying. It's enough to give you a complex. But I don't care. I'm too fascinated to hide indoors or stay cooped up in our yard. Curiosity killed the cat, I know, but I try to land on my feet. Right smack in the middle of the village is a huge kapok tree, which is where they get together and have their market every fifth day. Oh, that's something to see. All the ladies come to sell and bicker. They might have green bananas, pink bananas, mounds of rice and other whitish things piled on paper, onions or carrots or even peanuts if it's our lucky day, or bowls of little red tomatoes, misshapen things but highly prized. You might even see bottles of bright orange soda pop that someone walked here all the way from Leopoldville, I guess, and will walk a long way more before they're all sold. There's a lady that sells cubes of caramel-colored soap that look good to eat. Ruth May snitched one and took a bite, then cried hard, not so much from the bad taste as the disappointment, I imagine. There's so little here for a child in the way of sweets. Also, sometimes we'll see a witch doctor with aspirins, pink pills, yellow pills, and animal pieces all laid out in neat rows on a black velvet cloth. He listens to your ailments, then tells you whether you need to buy a pill, a good luck charm, or just go home and forget about it. That's a market day for you. So far, we've only purchased things from around the edges. We can't get up the nerve to walk in there whole hog and do our shopping. But it's fascinating to look down the rows and see all those long-legged women in their colorful panniers bent over almost double to inspect things laid out on the ground, and women pulling their lips up to their noses when they reach out to take your money. You watch all that noise and business, then look past them to the rolling green hills in the distance, with antelopes grazing under flat-top trees, and it doesn't fit together. It's like two strange movies running at the same time. On the other days, when there's no market, people just congregate in the main square for one thing and another, hairdos, shoe repair, or just gossiping in the shade. There's a tailor who sets up his foot-pedal sewing machine under the tree and takes their orders, simple as that. Hairdos are another matter, surprisingly complicated, given that the women have no real hair to speak of. They get it divided into rows of long parts in very intricate patterns, so their heads end up looking like balls of dark wool made of 100 pieces, very fancily stitched together. If they've got an inch or two to work with, the hairdresser will wrap sprigs of it in black thread so it stands up in little spikes like Mama Bwanda number twos. The hairdo business always draws an audience. The motto seems to be, if you can't grow your own, supervise somebody else's. The elderly women and men look on, working their gums, dressed in clothes exactly the same color as their skin, from all the many ground-in years of wash and wear. From a distance, you can't tell they have on anything at all, but just the faintest shadow of snow-white hair, as if Jack Frost lightly touched down on their heads. They look as old as the world. Any colorful thing they might hold in their hands, like a plastic bucket, stands out strangely. Their appearance doesn't sit square with the modern world. Mama Lo is the main hairdresser. She also runs a palm oil business on the side, getting little boys to squash it out of the little red oil palm nuts in her homemade press and selling it to the other villagers just a little each day for frying their greens and whatnot. Mama Lo doesn't have any husband, though she's as industrious as the day is long. With the way they do here, it seems like some fellow would snap her up as a valuable add-on to his family. She isn't a whole lot to look at, I'll grant you, with her sad little eyes and wrinkled mouth she keeps shut morning till night while she does everybody's hair. The state of her own hair is a mystery, since she always wraps her head in a dazzling cloth printed with peacock feathers. Those lively feathers don't really match her personality, but like Tata Bwanda in his ladies' wear sweater, she seems unaware that her outfit is ironic. If I settle down on a stump somewhere at the edge of the village square, they'll forget about me sooner or later, I've found. I like to sit there and keep an eye out for the woman with the great big white purse, exactly like what Mamie Eisenhower might take shopping, which she carries proudly through the village on her head. And I love to watch the boys climb up palm trees to cut down the oil nuts. Way high up there with the sunlight falling reddish-brown on the palm trunks and the boys' narrow limbs, they look beautiful. They seem touched by the Lord's grace. In any event, they never fall. The palm fronds wave around their heads like ostrich plumes. Twice I've seen the honey man who comes out of the forest carrying a block of honeycomb dripping with honey, sometimes bees and all, in his bare hands. A smoking roll of leaves juts from his mouth like a giant cigar. He sings softly to the bees as he walks through the village, and the children all run after him, mesmerized by the prospect of honey, their eagerness for a sweet causing them to vibrate and hum like the bees. On the rare days when Eben Axelrod is in his shack at the end of the airplane field, I've been known to go down there and spy on him, too. Sometimes Ada comes, although she generally prefers her own company to anyone else's. But Mr. Axelrod provides a grave temptation, as he is such an abominable curiosity. We hide amongst the banana trees that have sprung up all around his latrine, even while it gives us the creeps, knowing all this lush growth is fertilized by such a disgusting man's night soil. The big banana tree leaves grow right up against the shack's filthy back window, leaving narrow gaps perfect for spying. Mr. Axelrod himself is boring to watch. On a typical day, he sleeps till noon, then takes a nap. You can just tell he isn't saved. But his clutter is fascinating. Guns, tools, army clothes, even a radio of some kind, which he keeps in an army footlocker. We can hear the faint static emanating from the trunk and the spooky distant voices speaking French and English. My parents told us there was not a radio within 100 miles of our whole village. They wanted to get one for safety's sake, but neither the Mission League nor the Lord has so far provided. So they aren't aware of Mr. Axelrod's radio, and since I only learned of it through spying, I can't tell them about it. My parents shun him completely. Our mother is so sure none of us would want to go near his house, she hasn't bothered to forbid it. That's good luck for me. If no one has said outright that spying on Mr. Axelrod is a sin, then God probably couldn't technically hold it against me. The Hardy Boys did spying for the cause of good, and I have always felt mine is in this same vein. It was midway through September when Ruth May made her inroads. I came back from my spying foray one afternoon to find her playing Mother May I with half the village's children. I was flabbergasted. There stood my own little sister in the center of our yard, the focal point of a gleaming black arc of children strung from here to there, silently sucking their sugarcane sticks, not even daring to blink. Their faces concentrated on Ruth May the way a lens concentrates sunlight. I half expected her to go up in flames. "You, that one," Ruth May pointed and held up 4 fingers. "Take 4 scissor steps. The chosen child opened his mouth wide and sang a rising 4-note song. "Madame, may I?" "Yes, you may," Ruth May replied benevolently. The little boy crossed his legs at the knees, leaned back, and minced forward twice plus twice more, exactly like a crab that could count. I watched for a long while, astonished to see what Ruth May had accomplished behind my back. Every one of these children could execute giant steps, baby steps, scissors steps, and a few other absurd locomotions invented by Ruth May. She grudgingly let us join the game, and grudgingly we did. For several afternoons under the gathering clouds, all of us, including the generally above-it-all Rachel, played Mother May I. I tried to picture myself in a missionary role, gathering the little children unto me, as it was embarrassing to be playing this babyish game with children waist-high to me. But we were so tired of ourselves and each other by then, the company was irresistible. We soon lost interest, though, for there was no suspense at all. The Congolese children always passed us right by on their march to victory. In our efforts to eke the most mileage out of a scissors step or whatever, my sisters and I sometimes forgot to ask, or Ada to mouth, "Mother, may I?" Whereas the other children never, ever forgot. For them, shouting, "Madame, may I?" was one rote step in a memorized chain of steps, not a courtesy to be used or dropped the way "yes, ma'am" and "thank you" are for us. The Congolese children's understanding of the game didn't even take courtesy or rudeness into account, if you think about it, any more than Methuselah did when he railed us with hell and damnation. This came as a strange letdown to see how the game always went to those who knew the rules without understanding the lesson. But Mother May I broke the ice. When the other children got wise to Ruth May's bossy ways and drifted off, one boy stayed. His name was Pascal, or something near it, and he captivated us with frantic sign language. Pascal was my Nkundi, my first real friend in the Congo. He was about two-thirds my size, though much stronger, and fortunately for us both, he owned a pair of khaki shorts. Two frayed holes in the back gave a generous view of his buttocks, but that was all right. I rarely had to be directly behind him except when we climbed trees. The effect was still far less embarrassing to me than pure nakedness. I think I would have found it impossible to be friends with a purely naked boy. "Beto Nki Tutasala?" he would ask me by way of greeting. "What are we doing?" It was a good question. Our companionship consisted mainly of Pascal telling me the names for everything we saw and some things I hadn't thought to look for. Bangala, for example, the poisonwood tree that was plaguing us all half to death. Finally, I learned to see and avoid its smooth, shiny leaves. And he told me about Ngondi, the kinds of weather. Mawalala is rain far off in the distance that doesn't ever come. When it booms thunder and beats down the grass, that is Nuni Ndolo. And the gentler kind is Nkazi Ndolo. These he called boy rain and girl rain, pointing right to his private parts and mine without appearing to think a thing in the world was wrong with that. There were other boy and girl words, such as right and left, the man hand and the woman hand. These discussions came several weeks into our friendship after Pascal had learned that I was not actually a boy, but something previously unheard of, a girl in pants. The news surprised him greatly, and I don't like to dwell on how it came about. It had to do with peeing in the bushes. But Pascal quickly forgave me, and it's a good thing, since friends of my own age and gender were not available, the girls of Kalanga all being too busy hauling around firewood, water, or babies. It did cross my mind to wonder why Pascal had a freedom to play and roam that his sisters didn't. While the little boys ran around pretending to shoot each other and fall dead in the road, it appeared that little girls were running the country. But Pascal made a fine companion. As we squatted face to face, I studied his wide-set eyes and tried to teach him English words. Palm tree, house, run, walk, lizard, snake. Pascal could say these words back to me all right, but he evidently didn't care to remember them. He only paid attention if it was something he'd never seen before, such as Rachel's Timex watch with the sweep second hand. He also wanted to know the name of Rachel's hair. "Hair, hair," he repeated over and over, as if this were the name of some food he wanted to make sure he never got hold of by mistake. It only dawned on me later I should have told him blonde. Once we'd made friends, Pascal borrowed a machete and cut sugar cane for me to chew on. With hard, frightening whacks, he cut the cane into popsicle lengths before replacing the machete beside his father's hammock. The cane-sucking habit in Kalanga was no doubt connected to the black stumps of teeth most everyone showed off when they smiled at us, and Mother never lost an opportunity to remark upon that connection. But Pascal had a fine set of strong white teeth, so I decided to take my chances. I invited Pascal into our kitchen house when Mother wasn't there. We skulked about in the banana-smelling darkness, examining the wall over the plank counter where Mother tacks up pictures she tears out of magazines. They're company for her, I suppose, these housewives, children, and handsome men from cigarette ads, of which Father would disapprove if the Lord's path ever chanced to lead him through the kitchen, which isn't likely. Mother even has a photo of President Eisenhower in there. In the dimness, the President's pale, bulbous head shines out like a light bulb. Our substitute for electricity. But Pascal is always more interested in poking through the flour sacks, and he sometimes takes small handfuls of carnation milk powder. I find that substance revolting, yet he eats it eagerly as if it were candy. In exchange for his first taste of powdered milk, Pascal showed me a tree we could climb to find a bird's nest. After we handled and examined the pink-skinned baby birds, he popped one of them in his mouth like a jujube. It seemed to please him a lot. He offered a baby bird to me, pantomiming that I should eat it. I understood perfectly well what he meant, but I refused. He did not seem disappointed to have to eat the whole brood himself. On another afternoon, Pascal showed me how to build a 6-inch tall house. Crouched in the shade of our guava, he planted upright twigs in the dirt. Then he built the twigs into walls with a sturdy basket weave of shredded bark all the way around. He spat in the dirt to make red mud, then patted this onto the walls until they were covered. Finally, he used his teeth to square off the ends of palm fronds in a businesslike manner for the roof. Finally, he squatted back on his heels and looked over his work with an earnest, furrowed forehead. This small house of Pascal's, I realized, was identical in material and design to the house in which he lived. It only differed in size. It struck me what a wide world of difference there was between our sort of games, Mother May I, hide and seek, and his, find food, recognize poison wood, build a house. And here he was, a boy no older than 8 or 9. He had a younger sister who carried the family's baby everywhere she went and hacked weeds with her mother in the manioc field. I could see that the whole idea and business of childhood was nothing guaranteed. It seemed to me, in fact, like something more or less invented by white people and stuck onto the front end of a grown-up life like a frill on a dress. For the first time ever, I felt a stirring of anger against my father for making me a white preacher's child from Georgia. This wasn't my fault. I bit my lip and labored on my own small house under the guava tree, but beside the perfect talents of Pascal, my own hands lumbered like pale flippers on a walrus out of its element. My embarrassment ran scarlet and deep, hidden under my clothes. Ruth May Price. Every day Mama said, "You're going to crack your head wide open." But no, sir, I broke my arm instead. How I did it was spying on the African Communist Boy Scouts. Way up there in the tree, I could see them, but they couldn't see me. The tree had green alligator pears that taste like nothing much. Not a one of us but Mama will eat them, and the only reason is she can remember how they tasted back home from the Piggly Wiggly with salt and Hellman's mayonnaise. "Mayonnaise," I asked her. "What color was the jar?" But she didn't cry. Sometimes when I can't remember things from Georgia, she'll cry. They looked like regular Congo Boy Scouts to me, marching, except they didn't have any shoes. The Belgium Army men all have shoes and guns, and they come marching right straight through here sometimes on their way to somewhere. Father said that they are showing everybody Congolese, like Tata Undu, that Belgium is still calling the shots. But the other army is just boys that live around here. You can tell the difference. There aren't any white ones in charge, and they don't have all the same clothes. They've just got their shorts and barefooted or whatever they've got. One has got him a red Frenchy hat. Boy, I like that hat. The others have red hankies tied around their necks. Mama said they are not Boy Scouts. They are Jeune Mou Pro. She says, "Ruth May, sugar, you don't have a speck of business with the Jeune Mou Pro, so when you see them, why, you run on in the house." Mama does let us play with little children and boys, even if they're mostly naked, but not those ones in the red hankies. Mbote ve. That means no good. That's how I come to climb up the alligator pear tree when I saw them. For a long time, I thought Mama was saying they were the Jimmy Crow, a name I knew from home. In the morning, we can't spy. My sisters have to sit and have their school, and I have to color and learn my letters. I don't like having school. Father says a girl can't go to college because they'll pour water in your shoes. Sometimes I can play with my pets instead of coloring if I'm quiet. Here are my pets, Leon and the mongoose, also the parrot. My father let the parrot go because we accidentally taught it to say bad words, but it didn't go plumb away. It goes and then it comes back because its wings aren't any count. It got too tamed and forgot how to fly away and eat by itself. I feed it sour limes from the Dima tree to make it sneeze and wipe its bill off, one side and then the other. Mbote ve, Dima, Dimba, Dimbama. I like to say all those words because they come out of your mouth and laugh. My sisters feel sorry for the parrot, but I don't. I would have me a snake, too, if I could, because I'm not scared of them. Nobody ever even gave me the mongoose. It came to the yard and looked at me. Every day it got closer and closer. One day the mongoose came in the house, and then every day after that. It likes me the best. It won't tolerate anybody else. Leah said we had to name it Ricky Ticky Tabby, but no, sir, it's mine, and I'm a-calling it Stuart Little. That's a mouse in a book. I don't have a snake because a mongoose wants to kill a snake. Stuart Little killed the one by the kitchen house, and that was a good business, so now Mama lets it come on in the house. Dimba means listen. You listen here, Buster Brown. The snake by the kitchen house was a cobra that spits in your eyes. You go blind, and then it can just rear back and bite you any old time it feels like it. We went and found the chameleon all on our own. Leah mostly found that one on her bed. Most animals are whatever color God made them and have to stay that way, but Leon is whatever darn color he wants to be. We take him in the house when Mama and Father are still at church, and one time we put him on Mama's dress for an experiment, and he turned flowered. If he gets out and runs away in the house, oh boy, geez, old man, then we can't find him. Winda Mbote, goodbye, fare you well, and amen. So we keep him outside in a box that the comic books came in. If you poke him with a stick, he turns black with sparkles and makes a noise. We do that to show him who's boss. When I broke my arm, it was the day Mr. Axelrot was supposed to come. Father said that was good timing by the grace of God, but when Mr. Axelrot found out we had to go to Stanleyville, he turned around and took right off again up the river or something. Nobody knew, and he'd be back tomorrow. Mama said, "That man." Father said, "What were you doing shimmying up that tree in the first place, Ruth May?" I said Leah was supposed to be watching me, so it wasn't my fault. I said I was hiding from the Jimmy Crow boys. "Oh, for Pete's sake," Mama said. "What were you doing out there at all when I told you to run inside whenever you see them coming?" She was afraid to tell Father because he might whip me, busted arm and all. She told him I was a lamb of God and it was a pure accident, so he didn't whip me. Not yet. Maybe when I'm all fixed, he will. That arm hurt bad. I didn't cry, but I held it right still over my chest. Mama made me a sling out of the same bolt of cloth she brought over to make the bed sheets and baptizing dresses for the African girls. We haven't baptized any yet. Dunking them in the river, they won't have it. No, sir, nothing doing. Crocodiles. Mr. Axelrot did come back next day at noontime and smelled like when the fruit goes bad on you. Mama said it could wait one more day if we wanted to get there in one piece. She said lucky it was just a broken bone and not a snake bite. When we were waiting for Mr. Axelrot to sit in his airplane and get feeling better, the Congolese ladies came on down to the airplane field with great big old bags of manioc on their heads, and he gave them money. The ladies cried and yelled when he gave them the money. Father said that was because it was 2 cents on the dollar, but they don't even have regular dollars here. They use that pink money. Some of the ladies yelled hard at Mr. Axelrot and went away without giving him their stuff. Then we got in the plane and flew to Stanleyville, Mr. Axelrot, Father, and my broken arm. I was the first one of my sisters ever to break any bone but a toe. Mama wanted to go instead of him because I was a waste of Father's time. If she went, I'd get to ride on her lap, so I said that to him, too. I was going to waste his time. But no, then he decided after all he wanted to go walk on a city street in Stanleyville, so he went and Mama stayed. The back of the airplane was so full of bags I had to sit on them, big, scratchy brown bags with manioc and bananas and little cloth bags of something hard. I looked inside some of them, rocks, sparkly things, and dirty rocks. Mr. Axelrot told Father that food goes for the price of gold in Stanleyville, but it wasn't gold in the little cloth bags. No, sir. It was diamonds. I found that out, and I can't tell how. Even Father doesn't know we rode in an airplane with diamonds. Mr. Axelrot said if I told, why then God would make Mama get sick and die, so I can't. After I went to sleep and woke up again in the airplane, Mr. Axelrot told us what all we could see from up there looking down. Hippos in the river, elephants running around in the jungle, a whole bunch of them. A lion down by the water eating, its head moved up and down like our kitty in Atlanta. He told us there's little tiny pygmy people down there too, but we never saw any. Maybe too little. I said to him, "Where is all the green mamba snakes? I know they live up in a tree so they can drop on you and kill you, and I wanted to see some." Mr. Axelrot said there's not a thing in this world hides as good as a green mamba snake. They're just the same color as what they lay up against, he said, and they don't move a muscle. You could be right by one and not know it. We landed, nice as you please, on the grass. It was bumpier up in the sky than down on the grass. The big, huge house right there was the hospital, and they had a lot of white people inside and some other ones in white dresses. There were so many white people I forgot to count. I hadn't seen any but just us for a coon's age. The doctor said, "What was a nice preacher's girl doing up a tree?" The doctor had yellow hair on his arms and a big face and sounded foreign, but he didn't give me a shot, so I liked him all right. Father said that's just what her mother and I wanted to know. I said I didn't want anybody throwing me in a big pot and eating me, so I had to hide. The doctor smiled. Then I told him for real I was hiding from the Jimmy Crow, and the doctor didn't smile. He just looked at Father. Then he said to me, "Climbing trees is for boys and monkeys." "We don't have boys in our family," I told him. He laughed at that. He said, "Nor monkeys either, I should not think." He and Father talked about man things. The doctor was surprised about the Jimmy Crow boys being in our village. He didn't talk plain English like us. He said, "I cannot," instead of "I can't," and "they are," and "did not," and such. "They have heard," is what he asked Father. "They have heard of our Patrice Lumumba all the way down to Kalanga now?" Father said, "Oh, we don't see too much of them. We hear rifle practice on occasion." "Lord help us," said the doctor. Father told him why the Lord will help us. We'll receive his divine mercy as his servants who bring succor. The doctor frowned then. He said to forgive him, but he did not agree. He called my father Reverend. He said, Reverend, missionary work is a great bargain for Belgium, but it is a hell of a way to deliver the social services. He said that word, hell. I sucked in my breath and listened with my ears. Father said, Why, doctor, I'm no civil servant. Some of us follow careers, and some of us get called out. My work is to bring salvation into the darkness. Salvation, my foot, is what the doctor said. I do believe that man was a sinner, the way he says back at Father. We watched him mix up the white plaster and lay out strips. I hoped he and my father wouldn't get in a fight, or if they did, I hoped I could watch. I saw Father hit a man one time who did not praise the Lord. Without looking up from my arm, the doctor said, We Belgians made slaves of them and cut off their hands in the rubber plantations. Now you Americans have them for a slave wage in the mines and let them cut off their own hands. And you, my friend, are stuck with the job of trying to make amends. He was wrapping up my arm while he said all that about cutting off hands. He kept on wrapping the cool white strips around and around till it was all finished up and my arm inside like a hot dog in a bun. I was glad nobody wanted to cut off my hands. Because Jesus made me white, I reckon they wouldn't. He told me, that will bother you. We will take it off in 6 weeks. Okay, I said to his white coat sleeve. There was blood on it, somebody else's. But Father wasn't done with the doctor yet. He was hopping from one foot to the other and cried, Up to me to make amends. I see no amends to make. The Belgians and American business brought civilization to the Congo. American aid will be the Congo's salvation, you'll see. The doctor held my white broken arm like a big bone in his two hands, feeling how my fingers bent. He raised his yellow eyebrows without looking up at Father and said, Now, Reverend, this civilization the Belgians and Americans brought, what would that be? Father said, Why, the roads, railroads. The doctor said, Oh, I see. Then he bent down in his big white coat and looked at my face. He asked me, Did your father bring you here by automobile or did you take the passenger railway? He was just being a smart aleck, and Father and I didn't answer him. They don't have any cars in the Congo, and he knew it. He stood up then and clapped the white stuff off his hands, and I could see he was all done with my arm, even if Father wanted to argue till he went blue in the face. The doctor held the door open for us. Reverend, he said. Sir, asked my father. I do not like to contradict, but in 75 years the only roads the Belgians ever built are the ones they used to haul out diamonds and rubber. Between you and me, Reverend, I do not think the people here are looking for your kind of salvation. I think they're looking for Patrice Lumumba, the new soul of Africa. Africa has 1,000,000 souls, is what Father told him, and Father ought to know, for he's out to save them all. Well, yes, indeed, the doctor said. He looked out into the hallway and then closed the door with us still inside. He said in a lower voice, and about half of them were right here in Stanleyville last week to cheer on their Tata Lumumba. Father said, Tata Lumumba, who, from what I hear, is a barefoot post office worker who's never even been to college. That is true, Reverend. But the man has such a way of moving a crowd, he does not seem to need shoes. Last week he spoke for an hour on the nonviolent road to independence. The crowd loved it so much they rioted and killed 12 people. The doctor turned his back on us then. He washed his hands in a bowl and wiped them on a towel like Mama after the dishes. Then he came back and looked hard at my arm for a minute, and then at Father. He told my father there were only 8 Congolese men in all this land who've been to college. Not one single Congolese doctor or military officer. Nothing, for the Belgians don't allow them to get an education. He said, Reverend, if you're looking for Congo's new leaders, do not bother looking in a school hall. You might better look in prison. Mr. Lumumba landed himself there after the riots last week. By the time he's out, I expect he will have a larger following than Jesus. Ooh, boy, my father didn't like the doctor one bit after that. Saying anything is better than Jesus is a bad sin. Father looked up at the ceiling and out the window and tried not to hit anything until the doctor opened the door in time for us to go. The ceiling light was a clear glass bowl half full of something dark like a coffee cup, only it was dead bugs. I know why. They like to come up to the light because it's so, so pretty, like something they want, and then they get trapped in there. I know how they would feel if you touched them, like somebody's eyelashes right up against your fingers. When we came home, my sisters had to cut up my dinner every day and help me get dressed. It was the best thing that happened. I showed Leah where you could get into the alligator pear tree, and she boosted me up. I could still climb just dandy with my other arm. I have to play with Leah the most because the others in my family have got something wrong with them or else they're too grown up to play. We had to wait up there in the tree. I told her Mr. Axelrod drinks red whiskey. He has it under the seat of his airplane. I rolled it out with my foot and then put it back. I was the youngest, but I had something to tell. You don't ever have to wait around for the Belgium Army. They always come at the same time. Right after lunch, when it isn't raining yet, and all the women with their buckets and things have gone down to the river and the fields, and the men are home sleeping. It's quiet. Then the army boys will come a-marching down the road, saying a song in French. That white one knows who's boss, and all the others have to yell back because they are the tribes of Ham. But boy, oh boy, let me tell you, they all have shoes. They walk together hard in the road and then stop so fast the dust comes down on their shoes. The Jimmy Crow boys are harder to see. They don't care for the Belgium Army, so they hide out. They come just every now and then and have meetings in a place back behind our chicken house. They squat down to listen to the main one that talks, and their legs and arms are so skinny you can tell just what shape a bone is. And no shoes, either. Just white, scabby dust on the tops of their feet, and all of them with those dark black sores and scars. Every scar shows up good. Mama says their skin bears scars different from ours because their skin is a map of all the sorrows in their lives. We were waiting to spy on them back there behind the chicken house when they came. Leah told me Mama says Mrs. Underdown says don't even look at them if they come. They want to take over the whole country and throw out the whites. I said I'd like to have me a red hat like that. Shh, shut up, Leah said. But then she said, well, I would too. That's a good red hat. She said that because shut up hurt my feelings. The boys said, Patrice Lumumba. I told Leah that means the new soul of Africa and he's gone to jail and Jesus is real mad about it. I told her all that. I was the youngest one, but I knew it. I lay so still against the tree branch I was just the same everything as the tree. I was like a green mama snake, poison. I could be right next to you and you would never know it. Rachel. Well, hallelujah and pass the ammunition, company for dinner. And an eligible bachelor at that, without three wives, or even one as far as I know. Anatole, the schoolteacher, is 24 years of age, with all his fingers still on, both eyes, and both feet, and that is the local idea of a top-throb dreamboat. Well, naturally, he's not in my color category, but even if I were a Congolese girl, I'm afraid I'd have to say thanks, but no thanks, on Anatole. He has scars all over his face. Not accident scars, but thin little lines, the type that some of them here get done to them on purpose, like a tattoo. I tried not to stare, but you end up thinking, how did somebody get all the cuts to line up so perfect like that? What did they use, a pizza pie cutter or what? They were fine as a hair and perfectly straight, approximately a blue million of them, running from the middle of his nose to the sides of his face, like the ridges on a black corduroy skirt sewn on the bias, with the seam running right down the middle. It is not the kind of thing you see very much of here in our village, but Anatole is not from here. He's Congolese, all right, but he has a different kind of eyes that slant a little bit like a Siamese, only more intellectual. We all had to make every effort not to stare. There he sat at our dinner table with his smooth haircut and a regular yellow button-down shirt and his intelligent brown eyes blinking very normal when he listened to you, but then all those nerve-jangling scars. It gave him a mysterious air like a putative from the law. I kept stealing glances at him across a plate of antelope meat and stale potato buds, which I guess just goes to show you how unaccustomed to the male species I have become. Anatole speaks French and English both and single-handedly runs the school all by himself. 6 mornings a week, little noisy, dirt-kicking crowds of boys from our village and the next one over come straggling in for their education. It's only the boys, and not all of them either, since most of the parents don't approve of learning French or the foreign element in general. But when those lucky few show up every morning, Anatole lines them up, littlest to biggest. If ever you happen to be out and about in our village at the crack of dawn, as I try not to be, you can watch them do it. Each boy stands with his hand on the shoulder of the taller boy ahead, creating a big long slope of arms. Leah drew a picture of them. Granted, my sister is mentally disturbed. She titled it The Inclined Plane of Males. After the lineup, Anatole marches them into the church and urges them, I guess, to wrestle with their numbers and their French congregations and whatnot. But they only take it so far, you see. If they haven't already lost interest by the time they're 12 or so, their education is over and out. It's more or less something like a law. Imagine no school after age 12. I wouldn't mind. Ms. Underdown told us the Belgians have always had the policy of steering the Congolese boys away from higher education. Girls, too. I guess that goes without saying, because the girls around here, why, all they ever do is start having their own babies when they're about 10 and keep on having them till their boobies go flat as pancakes. Nobody has their eye on that all-important diploma, let me tell you. And yet here Anatole speaks French, English, Kikongo, and whatever all he first started out with, plus knowing enough to be the one all-purpose schoolteacher. He must have been busy as a beaver during his fleeting school days. Anatole was born up around Stanleyville, but at a tender age, with his mother being dead, got sent to work on the rubber plantations near Coquiatville, where more opportunities, both good and bad, present themselves. That was his way of putting it when he told us his personal life autobiography at dinner. He also spent some time at the diamond mines down south in Katanga, where he says one quarter of all the world's diamonds come from. When he spoke of diamonds, I naturally thought of Marilyn Monroe in her long gloves and pursy lips whispering, "Diamonds are a girl's best friend." My best friend, Dee Dee Baker, and I have snuck off to see M.M. and Brigitte Bardot both at the matinee. Father would flat out kill me if he knew. So you see, I know a thing or two about diamonds. But when I looked at Anatole's wrinkled brown knuckles and pinkish palms, I pictured hands like those digging diamonds out of the Congo dirt and got to thinking, gee, does Marilyn Monroe even know where they come from? Just picturing her in her satin gown and a Congolese diamond digger in the same universe gave me the weebie-jeebies, so I didn't think about it anymore. I inspected Anatole's special kind of face scarring instead. It is evidently considered beautifying in that region, or one of the places he's lived at any rate. Around here, the people seem content to settle for whatever scars life whangs them with as a decoration. That plus the spectacular hairdos on the women, which, man alive, don't even get me started. But Anatole not being from here, that explains why he doesn't have his mother and father and 1,400 cousins living with him like everybody else does. We'd already heard part of the story, that he was an orphan. The Underdowns took him on as a project because his family all got killed in some horrible way they love to hint at but never exactly tell. Back when they used to live here, they heard about Anatole from some other missionaries and saved him from the famous diamond mines and taught him to love Jesus and how to read and write. Then they installed him as the schoolteacher. Father says Anatole is our only ally in all this, which is as clear as mud to me, but apparently Father's say-so was a good enough reason to invite him to dinner. At least it gave us something to look forward to besides these wonderful dead animals we get to eat. And it provided Mother something to get all frantic-y about. She declared she was at her wit's end to come up with a presentable meal. She'd cooked up some antelope meat and tried to make fried plantains that turned into something like black horse hoof glue in the pan. She tried to make up for the food by using the white tablecloth and serving those pitiful black plantains in the bone china platter with the forget-me-nots that she was so proud of, her one pretty thing in this big old mess we have to live in. And I will say she did her best to be the graceful hostess. Anyways, Anatole gave her compliments right and left, which tells you right there he was either a polite young man or mentally cracked. The small talk and compliments went on so long I was fixing to croak. My sisters gawked at the fascinating stranger and hung on his every syllabus of English. But as far as I was concerned, it was just exactly like dinner with Father's prissy Bible study groups back in Georgia, only with more repulsive food. Then all of a sudden, the fire hit the pan. Anatole leaned forward and announced, "Our chief, Tata Ndu, is concerned about the moral decline of his village." Father said, "Indeed, he should be, because so few villagers are going to church." "No, Reverend, because so many villagers are going to church." Well, that stupefied us all for a special moment in time. But Father leaned forward, fixing to rise to the challenge. Whenever he sees an argument coming, man, oh man, does he get jazzed up. "Brother Anatole, I fail to see how the church can mean anything but joy for the few here who choose Christianity over ignorance and darkness." Anatole sighed. "I understand your difficulty, Reverend. Tata Ndu has asked me to explain this. His concern is with the important gods and ancestors of this village who have always been honored in certain sacred ways. Tata Ndu worries that the people who go to your church are neglecting their duties."
"Neglecting their duties to false idolatry, you mean to say?"
Anatole sighed again. "This may be difficult for you to understand. The people of your congregation are mostly what we call in Kikongo the Linzuka, people who have shamed themselves or had very bad luck or something like that. Tata Bwanda, for example, he has had terrible luck with his wives. The first one can't get any proper children, and the second one has a baby now who keeps dying before birth and coming back into her womb over and over. No one can help this family anymore. The Bwandas were very careful to worship their personal gods at home, making the proper sacrifices of food and doing everything in order, but still their gods have abandoned them for some reason. This is what they feel. Their luck could not get any more bad, you see, so they are interested to try making sacrifices to your Jesus." Father looked like he was choking on a bone. I thought, is there a doctor in the house? But Anatole went right on merrily ahead, apparently unaware he was fixing to kill my father of a heart attack. Tata Ndu is happy for you to draw the bad luck people away, he said, so the village's spirit protectors will not notice them so much. But he worries you're trying to lure too many of the others into following corrupt ways. He fears a disaster will come if we anger the gods. Corrupt, did you say? Father stated, rather than asked, after locating where the cat had put his tongue. Yes, Reverend Price. Corrupt ways? Tata Ndu feels that bringing the Christian word to these people is leading them to corrupt ways? That is the best way I can think of to translate the message. Actually, he said you are leading our villagers down into a hole where they may fail to see the proper sun and become trapped like bugs on a rotten carcass. Well, that did it. Father was going to keel plumb over. Call the ambulance. And yet, here was Anatole looking back at Father with his eyebrows raised very high like, do you understand plain English? Not to mention my younger sisters who were staring at Anatole like he was the Ripley's Believe It or Not two-headed calf. Tata Ndu asked you to relay all that, did he? Yes, he did. And do you agree that I am leading your fellow villagers to partake of the meat of a rotten corpse? Anatole paused. You could see him trying out different words in his head. Finally, he said, Reverend Price, do I not stand beside you in your church every Sunday, translating the words of the Bible and your sermons? My father did not exactly say yes or no to that, though of course it was true. But that's Father to a T. He won't usually answer a question straight. He always acts like there's a trap somewhere and he's not about to get caught in it. Instead, he asked, and Anatole, do you not now sit at my table translating the words of Tata Ndu's Bible of False Idolatry and his sermon aimed at me in particular? Yes, sir, that's what I'm doing. Father laid his knife and fork crossways on his plate and took a breath, satisfied he'd gained the upper hand. Father specializes in the upper hand. Brother Anatole, I pray every day for understanding and patience in leading Brother Ndu to our church, he said. Perhaps I should pray for you as well. This was Big Chief Ndu they were talking about, or Mr. Ndu, as Ruth May calls him. And I don't mind saying he's a piece of work. It is hard to muster up the proper respect for a chief who wears glasses with no glass in them. He seems to think they raise his intelligence quotient, and the fur of a small animal clasped around his neck, a fashion trademark he shares with the elderly church-going ladies of Georgia. Charmed, I'm sure. If you are counting your enemies, you should not count me among them, sir, Anatole said. And if you fear the rivals of your church, you should know there is another Nganga here, another minister. People also put their trust in him. Father loosened his tie and the collar of his short-sleeved Sunday shirt. First of all, young man, I do not fear any man in Kalanga. I am a messenger of God's great good news for all mankind, and he has bestowed upon me a greater strength than the brute ox or the most stalwart among the heathen. Anatole calmly blinked at that. I reckon he was wondering which one Father had him pegged for, brute ox or stalwart heathen. Second, Father went on, I'll point out what you clearly must know, which is that Brother Ndu is not a minister of any kind. His business concerns the governing of human relations, not matters of the spirit. But you're quite right. There is another preacher aside from myself guiding my own right hand. The Lord is our shepherd. Naturally, Father had to give the impression he knew who or what Anatole was talking about, even if he didn't. What with him being the Father knows best of all times. Yes, yes, of course, the Lord is our shepherd, Anatole said quickly, like he didn't believe it all that much and was just getting it out of the way. But I am speaking of the Nganga Tata Kuvudundu. We all stared at the middle of the table like something dead with feet had just turned up there. Why, we knew Tata Kuvudundu. We'd seen him babbling and walking cockeyed down the road, leaning over so far you keep thinking he'll plumb fall over. He has six toes on one of his feet, and that's not even half the battle. Some days he sells aspirins in the market, all dignified like Dr. Kildare. Yet other days he'll turn up with his body painted top to bottom, and I do mean bottom, in some kind of whitewash. We've also seen him squatting in his front yard surrounded by other old men, every one of them falling over from drinking palm wine. Father told us Tata Kuvudundu conducts the sin of false prophecy. Supposedly he and his grown-up sons tell fortunes by throwing chicken bones into a calabash bowl. Anatole, what do you mean by calling him a preacher? Mother asked. We kind of thought Tata Kuvudundu was the town drunk. No, Mama Price, he is not. He is a respected Nganga, a priest of the traditions, you might say. He's quite a good advisor to Tata Undu.
Advisor nothing, said Father, raising halfway up out of his chair and starting to get his Baptist voice.
His red eyebrows flared above his scowling eyes, with the bad ones starting to squint a little from the strain of it all.
He is a rare nut, is what he is, a nut of the type that never falls far from the tree. Where I come from, sir, that is what we call a witch doctor.
Anatole took one of Mother's cloth napkins and blotted his face. Dots of perspiration were running into the little ridges along his nose. My sisters were still staring at him with all their might, and no wonder. We hadn't had any company since Mother vanished Mr. Axelrot from our table way last summer, merely because he spat and cursed. We didn't even know yet that he was a criminal element that would charge us for our own things. Since that time, we hadn't heard word one of English at our dinner table from any mouth but a Price's. 6 months is a long time for a family to tolerate itself without any outside distractions. Anatole seemed to be getting ants in his pants, but was still bound and determined to argue with Father, in spite of the 7 warning signals of "You'll be sorry" written all over Father's face. Anatole said, "Tata Kuvadundu looks after many practical matters here. Men go especially to him when their wives are not getting children, or if they are adulterous." He glanced at me, of all things, as if I in particular were too young to know what that meant, really. Mother suddenly snapped out of it. "Help me out, girls," she said. "The dishwater is boiling away on the stove. I forgot all about it. You all clear the table and start washing up. Be careful and don't get burned." To my surprise, my sisters practically ran from the table. They were curious, I'm sure, but the main consideration had to be Father. He was as frustrated as it gets and looked like he was fixing to throw a rod. I, however, didn't leave. I helped clear the dishes, but then I sat back down. If anybody presumed I was too young for a conversation about adulterers and not getting babies, they had another thing coming. Besides, this was the most exciting occasion that had happened to us since Ruth May fell out of a tree, which goes to show you how fascinating our life was. If Big Daddy-O was going to blow his stack over a witch doctor, here's one cat that wasn't going to miss it. Anatole told Father he ought not to think of Tata Kuvadundu as competition. He said barrenness and adultery were serious matters that probably ought to remain separate from Tata Jesus. But he assured us that many people in Kalanga remembered the missionary times when Brother Fowles had gotten practically the whole town praying to Jesus, and it was their recollection that the gods hadn't been too angry over it since no more bad things happened in Kalanga than usual. Well, that did it. Remembered the missionary times? This was a nerve shock even to me, to hear that the villagers thought Christianity was like some old picture show that was way out of date. What did that make Father, then? Charlie Chaplin, waddling around duck-footed, waving his cane and talking without any sounds coming out? Mother and I watched him, expecting the dreaded atomic blow-up. Father actually did open and close his mouth like a silent picture version of what or wah, and his neck turned red. Then he got very still. You could hear Ruth May's creepy pet mongoose scurrying around under the table looking for somebody to drop something. Then Father's whole face changed, and I knew he was going to use the special way of talking he frequently perpetuates on his family members, dogs that have peed in the house, and morons, with his words saying one thing that's fairly nice and his tone of voice saying another thing that is not. He told Anatole he respected and valued his help, meaning I've had about enough of your lip, Buster Brown, but was disappointed by the villagers' childlike interpretations of God's plan, meaning you are just as big of a dingwit as the rest of them. He said he would work on a sermon that would clear up all the misunderstandings. Then he announced that this conversation had come to an end, and Anatole could consider himself excused from the table and this house, which Anatole did, without delay. "Well, that puts a whole new outlook on things, doesn't it?" Mother asked in the very quiet silence that followed. I kept my head down and cleared off all the last things except the big blue-flowered platter in the middle of the table, which I couldn't reach without crossing into Father's atomic danger zone. "I wonder what outlook you might think that to be," he said to Mother in that same special voice for bad dogs and morons. She brushed her hair out of her face and smiled at him as she reached across for the china platter. "Well, for one thing, sir, you and the good Lord better hope no lightning strikes around here in the next 6 months." "Orleana, shut up," he yelled, grabbing her arm hard and jerking the plate out of her hand. He raised it up over her head and slammed it down hard on the table, cracking it right in two. The smaller half flipped upside down as it broke and lay there dribbling black plantain juice like blood under the tablecloth. Mother stood helplessly, holding her hands out to the plate like she wished she could mend its hurt feelings. "You were getting too fond of that plate, don't you think I've noticed?" She didn't answer him. I had hoped you might know better than to waste your devotion on the things of this world, but apparently I was mistaken. I'm ashamed of you. You're right, she said quietly. I was too fond of that plate. He studied her. Father's not the one to let you get away with simply apologizing. He asked her with a mean little smile, "Who were you showing off for here with your tablecloth and your fancy plate?" He said the words in a sour way as if they were well-known sins. Mother merely stood there before him while all the sparkle drained out of her face. "And your pitiful cooking, Orleana! The way to a young Negro's heart is through his stomach, is that what you were counting on?" Her light blue eyes had gone blank, like shallow pans of water. You could honestly not tell what she was thinking. I always watch his hands to see which way they're going to strike out, but Mother's shallow water eyes stayed on his face without really looking at it. Finally, he turned away from her and me both with his usual disgust. He went and sat at his desk, leaving us all in a silence even greater than before. I suppose he was working on the famous sermon he'd promised, which would clear up all misunderstandings. And since it's none other than Anatole himself who stands beside Father and translates the sermons into their language, I'm sure he figured Anatole would be the very first one of the childlike dog-pea dingwit congregation to be touched by God's pure light. Ada Price. Walk to learn, eye and path. Long one is Congo. Congo is one long path, and I learn to walk. That is the name of my story, forward and backward. Manene is the word for path. Manene, enenam, amen. On the Congo's one long manene, Ada learns to walk. Amen. One day she nearly does not come back. Like Daniel, she enters the lion's den, but lacking Daniel's pure and unblemished soul, Ada is spiced with the flavors of vice that make for a tasty meal. Pure and unblemished souls must taste very bland, with an aftertaste of bitterness. Tata Ndu reported the news of my demise. Tata Ndu is chief of Kilanga and everything past it in several directions. Behind his glasses and striking outfit, he possesses an imposing bald forehead and the huge triangular upper body of a comic book bully. How would he even know about a person like me, the white little crooked girl, as I was called? Yet he did. The day he visited my family, I had been walking alone, making my way home on the forest path from the river. It was a surprising event for him to come to our house. He had never gone out of his way to see my father, only to avoid him, though he sometimes sent us messages through Anatole, his own sons, or other minor ambassadors. This day was different. He came because he had learned I was eaten by a lion. Early that afternoon, Leah and I had been sent to bring back water, sent together, the twin and the newt, N-I-W-T, chained together always in life as in pre-life. There was little choice, as Her Highness Rachel is above manual labor and Ruth May beneath it, so to speak. So Leah and I were considered by our mother, by default, disposed for her errands. It is always the twin and the newt she sends out to the marché on market day to walk among all those frightening women and bring back fruit or a kettle or whatever things she needs. She even sends us sometimes to bring back meat from the butcher marché, a place where Rachel will not set foot on account of the intestines and neatly stacked heads. We can look out our door and know when the butcher marché is open for business, if the big kapok tree down there is filled with black buzzards. This is the truth. We call them the Congolese billboard. But above all else, and every day, she would send us to get water. It was hard for me to carry the heavy pail with my one good hand, and I went too slowly. Slowly, too, went I. My habit on that path was reciting sentences forward and back, for the concentration improved my walking. It helped me forget the tedium of moving only one way through the world, the way of the slow, slow body. So Leah took all the water and went ahead, as always. The forest path was a live thing underfoot that went a little farther every day. For me, anyway, it did. First, it went only from one side of our yard to the other, what our mother could see and deem safe if she stood in the middle. At first, we only heard stories about what happened to it on the north after the forest closed down on it. A stream, a waterfall, clear pools for swimming. It went to a log bridge. It went to another village. It went to Leopoldville. It went to Cairo. Some of these stories were bound to be true, and some were not. To discover the line between, I decided to walk. I became determined to know a few steps more of that path every day. If we stayed long enough, I would walk to Johannesburg and Egypt. My sisters all seem determined to fly, or in Rachel's case, to ascend to heaven directly through a superior mindset. But my way was slowly and surely to walk. What I do not have is kakakaka, the Kikongo word for hurrying up. But I find I can go a long way without kakakaka. Already I had gone as far as the pools and the log bridge on the north, and south to clearings where women wearing babies in slings stoop together with digging sticks and sing songs, not hymns, and grow their manioc. Everyone knows those places, but without kakakaka I discover sights of my own, how the women working their field will stand up one after another, unwrap the panier of bright cloth tied under their breasts, stretch it out wide before retying it. They resemble flocks of butterflies opening and closing their wings. I have seen the little forest elephants that move in quiet bands, nudging the trees with their small pinkish tusks. I have seen bands of pygmies, too. When they smile, they reveal teeth filed to sharp points, yet they are gentle and unbelievably small. You can only believe they are men and women by their beards and breasts and the grown-up way they move to protect their children. They always see you first and grow still as tree trunks. I discovered the Bedila de Papfumu, the cemetery of witch doctors. I discovered a bird with a black head and mahogany-colored tail as long as my arm, curved like a bow. In the field guide to African birds left by our foul-minded patron, Brother Fowles, my bird is called the Paradise Flycatcher. In the notebook I keep in my pillowcase, in which I draw pictures of all things I know, I put a smile on the face of the paradise flycatcher and printed underneath, in my backward code for secrecy, Neva'e ni silf fo furpwen, recta silf esidarp arp. Paradise flycatcher. New proof of flies in heaven. I also made a habit of following Methuselah as he made his way around our house in insecure spirals. He roosts right inside our latrine, which is near where his empty cage was thrown by the Reverend into the weeds. Its hulk rots there like a shipwreck. Methuselah, like me, is a cripple, the wreck of wild Africa. For all time, since the arrival of Christ, he had lived on 17 inches of a yardstick. Now he has a world. What can he possibly do with it? He has no muscle tone in his wings. They are atrophied, probably beyond hope of recovery. Where his pectoral muscles should be, he has a breast weighed down with the words of human beings. By words, interred, free as a bird, absurd, unheard. Sometimes he flaps his wings as if he nearly remembers flight, as he did in the first jubilant terror of his release. But his independence was frozen in that moment. Now, after stretching his wings, he retracts them again, stretches out his head, and waddles, making his tedious way up one branch and down another. Now Methuselah creeps each morning out of the little hole under the rafters of our latrine house, cocks his head, and casts one nervous eye upward as if in prayer. Lord of the feathers, deliver me this day from the carnivores that could tear me breast from wishbone. From there I track his path. I set out small offerings of guava and avocado I have picked and broken open, exposing them to him as food. I do not think he would recognize these fruits wholly concealed in their own skins. After he learns to do that, it will be another whole step to make him see that fruit is not a thing he must rely on the hands of mankind for, but grows on trees. Treason grows but for kind man. In following Methuselah on his slow forays through the forest, I discovered the boys and men practicing drills. This was not the Belgian army, official conscripted protectors of white people, but a group of young men who held secret meetings in the woods behind our house. I learned that Anatole is more than a teacher of schoolboys and translator of sermons. Ah, Anatole. The lot. Anaha. Anatole carried no gun in the clearing where I spied him, but he spoke to armed men who listened. Once he read aloud a letter about the Belgians setting a timetable for independence. Anatole said 1964, 1964. The men threw back their heads at this and laughed ferociously. They cried out as if their skin had been torn. I feared not and grew accustomed to walking alone. Our mother did not think she allowed it, especially near dark. It was my secret. She never did realize that whenever she sent me anywhere with Leah, such as to the creek that day to carry water, it would mean coming back alone. It was already late afternoon, and I passed through spotted light, then brighter clearings, with grass so tall it bent from both sides to form a tunnel overhead, then back under trees again. Leah long gone ahead of me with the water. But someone was behind, someone or something. I understood perfectly well that I was being followed. I cannot say I heard anything, but I knew. I wanted to think Methuselah is playing a trick on me, or the pygmies, but I knew better. I paid attention to the small hairs rising on my nape. I did not feel afraid because it does no good in my case. I cannot run away on the muscular.